All right, hello everybody. So hopefully you can hear me. I'm trying this new mic out. I think everything should be working, but let me know if you cannot. I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen so we can get started here. And I'm going to pull up first the set of questions. These were submitted by Nicola. Okay, so basically she had a question about her SIBO lab. I'm going to show you this lab. So the question was basically in that there, she felt like she did the diet really, really well. And you can see here with this lab that the baseline value here was 60. So it's really high. So the question she had was really just regarding the baseline, the prep diet, and just making sure that she was doing the prep diet correctly and why there might be something that came up with an improper prep diet. So basically, one thought about this, my first thought about this is the fact that there could have been teeth brushing. So brushing one's teeth before this test or during or in the middle of this test actually can make a big difference with the quality of the baseline value. So it's really important that we're not brushing teeth. And so oftentimes I find that in situations where people do these tests and that baseline looks high, despite them saying they did a good prep diet, they miss that in the instructions about avoiding toothpaste. So that is my suggestion or my thought as to why that probably happened. And so another thing that you said, Nicola, was that you found that taking the breast samples a little odd at first. You felt like you got better at doing it as you went along. It's possible. That's definitely possible, but and definitely something to consider. But I would definitely first look at and say, did you use toothpaste that day? So another thing with colloidal silver is not you, with you not understanding it. With colloidal silver, remember, we don't want to use any colloidal silver on the market. So we want to use colloidal silvers with small particle size or parts per million, so particle size. So Progressive Labs makes a great one. That's who we use for colloidal silver. It is antimicrobial in general, meaning it can be used for viral, it can be used for bacterial, it can be used for fungal. So we use it often for Marcon's infections in the nose. So remember, Marcon's is a common infection. It's common in people with Lyme or with people with mold. And Marcon's is an acronym. It stands for multiple antibiotic resistant coagulase negative staph. And what's so interesting about Marcon's is it is this type of staph, and it lives way back here, way back in the sinus cavity, kind of all the way back at the level where we're talking about the Eustachian tube actually coming into meet the pharynx here. So that's about the level of how far back we are talking about this staph living. Now, it's also interesting, and this is a little bit of passed down from other docs, that it can often live behind calcified fungal infections. So there's this doc out on the East Coast who does really interesting work. He's an ENT, Dr. Dennis, I'm blanking on his last name right now, and he basically will do surgeries for Marcon's where he goes in and he actually scrapes the sinuses and he's breaking up those calcifications so that the antimicrobials can actually get to the Marcon's infections. So according to his work, he talks about how he thinks that Marcon's, one of the reasons why it's so difficult to treat and a lot of treatments don't work very well is because of the fact that we're not getting to the actual Marcon's because it's actually living behind that fungal calcification. So colloidal silver can be a great treatment to use for something like a Marcon's because it does have antifungal and antibacterial effects. So we can get work done on the fungus as well as that Marcon's at the same time. When we use colloidal silver for things like Marcon's, we've been using a nebulizer these days to really try to disseminate the medicine, and we're using colloidal silver in the nebulizer, and we're really trying to disseminate that medicine throughout the sinus cavity. So that's going to be really, really important for that. So as far as how to use it, I would definitely use it for viral, bacterial, or fungal infections. Just make sure you're getting something like Progressive Labs so you have a good parts per million there. And this is a really interesting conversation, the next question that you bring up, Nicola, because it shows exactly how far we've come with autoimmunity and research. So your question is about the whole Th1, Th2 dominance with autoimmunity. This comes originally from Dattis Karazian's work, and this comes from research that is kind of outdated at this point. So there was a point when the best research we had said, oh, there could be a Th1 or 2 or Th2 dominant situation, and perhaps we need to balance out the Th1 or Th2 dominance in working with autoimmunity. But there's been a lot of research that's come out since that original theory and since that original research, Fasano's work being some of it. Fasano's work is that triad of there's always the genetic predisposition, that epigenetic factor, and then leaky gut. So that's much more recent research. And basically with the Th1, Th2 dominant situation, it really kind of oversimplified things. So it didn't really look at things like the gut. It didn't really look at things such as Th17 cells or T regulatory cells. So we don't really look at Th1 versus Th2 dominance at all when it comes to autoimmunity. We mainly just look at Fasano's work, looking at the leaky gut situation, the root cause of leaky gut, looking at that environmental trigger. So we do that. And then the other thing that's really important that we do, if we're still having problems, is we look at T regulatory cells. So T regulatory cells have been shown to have vitamin D and vitamin A receptors on them. So making vitamin D and vitamin A really great for upregulating Tregs. And Tregs, remember, are exactly what their name implies. They're immune cells that are regulating the immune system. So when we have an overactive immune system, such as with autoimmunity, it's really the T regulatory cells that kind of prevent the immune system from being on overdrive, from firing all the time. So by doing things like vitamin A and vitamin D, we can really work with the Tregs. So I would basically, in response to your question, I would say that was kind of an old theory, the Th1, Th2 conversation, and there's been newer research that's come out since then. So what else to say? Oh, clinically, as far as this is concerned, when I first started my clinical practice, I was doing some Th1, Th2 dominant stuff. This was about a decade ago when it came to autoimmune disease. And what I found was very underwhelming. So I actually was really excited when I first found Fasano's work because it really made sense to me. And at that point in time, I wasn't having very good luck with changing Th1 or changing autoimmunity based upon what I was seeing in labs and with symptoms when I was working with Th1, Th2 dominance. And I can tell you, since Fasano's work has come out, I can clinically back up the research and the theory, because it is very rare that using this whole, say, autoimmune triad, this leaky gut triad, that we are not changing autoimmunity and getting it to reverse, getting lab markers going to normal, getting the disease process to reverse. And until Fasano's work, I really hadn't seen anything that could clinically do what this triad is doing. So that's my thoughts on that. Don't really, like I said, look at the Th1, Th2 thing because of that. Okay, and then, so I wanted to also show you guys this. This was given to us recently by one of the Gary over at Aerodiagnostics, the SIBO lab and the founder of Aerodiagnostics, sent us this. Miles was on the phone with him and talking about sometimes when we see a no rise, when we see no change, when we're thinking about hydrogen sulfide. And so basically one of the things that Gary recommended is if you see a SIBO test and you're seeing that that hydrogen level is flatlined all across the board, even into the third hour, that we want to confirm a true negative. So we want to basically confirm that it's hydrogen sulfide. And so in order to do that, we want to ask the following. So we want to ask if the patient actually drank the lactulose. So if they did not drink the lactulose, there would obviously be no fermentation that would happen, and therefore this test would look like a flat line. So we want to actually make sure they did take that substance. We want to make sure that they mixed it with water. So if they didn't mix it with water, it's possible that some of the lactulose remain in the mouth and did not make its way to the small intestine. So we really want to check in on how they did take that lactulose, that they did take it in the right amount. We also wanted to see if they had a recent colonic. One of the reasons why they do not, you know, they say do not do a recent colonic before doing a SIBO test is because it's going to flush out the bacteria of the large intestine. So those large intestine, the colonic bacteria numbers are going to be lower. So when we're talking about that third hour, we would expect to see a flat line in the third hour if they had recently done a colonic because we flushed out that bacteria. So if they had heavy diarrhea at the time of the test, that would essentially flush bacteria out and it would not allow enough of that fermentation. So laxatives, heavy doses of laxatives, if it's causing diarrhea, would essentially do the same thing. If the patient had a virus at the time of the test, we'd also be worried about flushing bacteria out of the large intestine. So we could create a false negative from that. So if all of these tests are, or all of these questions are no, the patient hadn't used laxatives, they did not have a colonic, they did not have a virus, they did do the lactulose properly, meaning they took it, they mixed it with water, then basically they are definitely a potential hydrogen sulfide case. So then we want to see, do they have flatulence? Does it smell like sulfur? If all of that is true, then yes, this is likely hydrogen sulfide. Now, a couple other questions, just basic questions, is we want to make sure the patient's not on the elemental diet at the time of this test, because that could also cause that level to be flatlined. And we want to make sure that the patient has a colon. Remember, that third hour is because of the lactulose being in the colon and the colonic bacteria stimulating that. So if somebody had their colon removed, which obviously does not happen very often, I think in my decade of practice, I've had one patient with a colon without a colon. So obviously doesn't have to happen often, but that would certainly screw up the test result. So it's worth verifying that if you do not know that already. So now the next thing to show you is this organic. So Brooke submitted a case. Let me see, where did my case go? Give me 1 second. Excuse me. Okay, so let's go back to these questions from Brooke here. And I know there's a couple other questions that Nicola had in here as well. Okay, so here's one of Nicola's. So Nicola just received results from an IgE, Vibrant America test, and she was a little bit concerned because she had somebody that came back as in control, green box, meaning very little to no reaction for cat epithelia. But this person has extremely obvious allergic reactions. So she's wondering, is this test credible with this type of result? So honestly, some of our results from some of these tests. So Vibrant America has their IgE. We also use Dunwoody's Food Lab. So we've seen this come up a couple times actually with both companies where somebody has a very clear, obvious reaction to something, whether it's something like a cat or food, and the test does not pick it up. So it's definitely something to, you know, consider. It can be, say, a couple of different reasons. One could be that the antigen the company is using is not as good as other antigens, that some antigens they're using are not as reliable as others. So that's something is, you know, definitely something to consider. So if any, you know, what I feel on these types of tests is that I still find them to be clinically useful because oftentimes there are things that come up and we do take them out and people do feel better, but they are not perfect. And I see that, like I said, I see that with the food test across the board that they're a guide and they're not 100% perfect. So that's a big thing to consider with that is that it is just a guide. So anytime we're seeing, say, an IgE come up, we really want to consider a couple of things. We really want to consider taking the food out or avoiding something and seeing how the person feels to kind of verify that that result was true. So that's one thing that's important. And then beyond that, we also need to consider things like IgG4s. So this would be in a case of an opposite thing. If say cats came up and they were red and the person experienced no reactions to the cats. This is an area where Dunwoody's test is adds greater value because Dunwoody's test gives us that IgG4 and that subtype, remember, I think we talked about this one or two webinars ago, that subtype, that IgG4, is going to downregulate an IgE response. So basically an IgE that would be positive in this case would actually not produce symptoms because they were appropriately counterbalancing that positive test. So that's something to consider as well. Obviously, that's an opposite situation of what you're talking about here, Nicola. So, you know, what you're talking about is something is green and there's this obvious reaction. So I do think that, yes, there's some credibility. I know when Miles has several allergies, and when he ran the Vibrant test, they nailed his allergies perfectly. So he was, you know, and at the levels that he was anticipating. So it was one of the things that we were doing when we were first using Vibrant's test is, you know, Miles has clear allergies, some even anaphylactic. So we were saying, okay, well, how well is a test going to pick this up? And it actually picked the, Miles's allergies up really well. And then another thing you mentioned is that this person tested moderate for 30 foods, including very healthy things. So this is definitely, you know, very interesting. And this is obviously an IgE. So I would definitely do kind of what I mentioned, like use this as a foundation for an elimination. So basically avoid them, take these 30 things, avoid them strictly for 3 weeks, add one at a time and see how they handle it. See if they handle it okay. If they don't handle, so they add coconut back in and they're like that, they don't handle that well, wait at least 3 days for them to clear some of those IgEs before you add the next one in. But basically that's what I would do is basically I would do a rotation diet to basically see if they actually are a problem. Because again, Vibrant is also only testing the IgEs and we don't know from this example if the IgG4s are present, you know, which could be very important. So another thing to consider that you mentioned is that she was moderately reactive to seaweed with kelp. And she did have some hypothyroid and some iodine deficiency. And iodine supplements are often made of seaweed and kelp. So it is a good good thing to bring up. I definitely agree with a moderate level here. She could have IgG4s. likely taking the iodine to improve the thyroid function. It does take precedence here. So that's definitely something that I would do. Now, remember with iodine, we talked about the iodine halide test, and you mentioned that here. So definitely a good idea to do the iodine halide test to see if somebody is iodine deficient. So with that, that can tell us if there is an iodine need. And then we still want to be careful in supplementing iodine if there's an autoimmune disease present. And remember that oftentimes there can be autoimmune disease present. There can be Hashimoto's, and we may not see the autoimmune antibodies present. So we can have positive Hashimoto's even though we have negative antibodies. So that's something else to consider, is that we want to make sure that we are not just assuming that that Hashimoto's is negative. It's estimated that Hashimoto's is present more of the time than is actually found on lab tests. So what we do in the light of an iodine deficiency is we first ask that question. If we're feeling confident that it's not Hashimoto's, then we can sometimes start a little bit more aggressively with the iodine. And seeing that we already know that there's iodine deficient, we're pretty safe to move forward with iodine supplementation. So we can start fairly low. We always want to start fairly low with iodine, and we want to titrate up. So using about 150 micrograms, so it's 150 micrograms, not milligrams, that's a good starting dose. We start with that just one day. And basically when we're doing that, then we titrate them up from there. So we titrate them up so that then they are up to, sometimes even up to 2 or even very rarely 3 milligrams. But adding an extra 150 micrograms every few days, adding another drop. There's a lot of companies have products that are 150 microgram drops. Sometimes they go up to like 400 microgram drops. So definitely get one with 150 micrograms so you can titrate slowly. And basically about every 4 to 6 weeks, you want to monitor the thyroid when you're doing this. So we want to make sure that we are seeing what is happening to the thyroid really quickly. You don't have to do a full thyroid panel, but just doing a TSH and a free T3 is plenty. So monitoring that every 4 to 6 weeks and seeing how your progress is going. And that will let you know if it's working, if it's hurting anything. And also in titrating up that way, we find that the thyroid, quote unquote, say, accepts iodine a little bit better. And we don't see people react in the same sort of ways if we were to just start them on like a super high, say, 2 milligram type of dose. So then in light of the IgE moderation issue with seaweed, I would still move into fully supplementing with iodine. I would just watch how you're feeling, how this person is feeling. So mainly seeing that fatigue or, you know, other symptoms that are present, mainly feeling that that is not getting worse. And if there's no obvious reaction eating seaweed, I would go ahead and try to get to full dose here. Okay, so this one was Brooke. Oh, this one was interesting. This was an interesting case, Brooke. So frequent UTIs, which is not uncommon, but what is uncommon is that there are no symptoms. So basically when this woman's doing her annual checkups, it's coming up positive, but there's no burning or discomfort. So this person came to you with a previous organic acids test done, which I'll pull up. You submitted that. And you also want to know what else to look into as far as bacteria in the urine. So let's look at that and then we'll come back to this case. So basically when we're reading the organic test, and when you look at the organic video that's in the MMCP, how I created that was really just looking at and going over things like the neurotransmitters and the detoxification components, because those are the only components of this test that are not just kind of obvious just by looking at it, meaning that when we're looking here, let me get a pen here. When we're looking here, say under fatty acid metabolism, and we see that, oh, all of these things here under fatty acid metabolism are carnitine and B2, could mean carnitine and B2 deficient. So all that we're really learning here is that any one of these things labeled 1, 2, or 3 could be a carnitine or B2 deficiency. And having a, say, a certain combination or one of them higher, another of them lower, none of that is indicating anything different. So we're looking at how fatty acids are broken down. And if we're seeing here this ethyl malonate is high, that can mean a carnitine or B2 deficiency. If just suberate was high, that could be carnitine or B2. If just adipate was high, that could be carnitine or B2. And seeing that some are normal and others are not isn't really giving us any information saying, oh, this is valid or invalid. All it's saying is that with the biochemical pathways that lead to these substrates or these metabolites being created, these three metabolites, all three of these metabolites need carnitine and B2 in order to be created. So basically what we're saying there is that if any of one of these are elevated, we can have deficiencies of these two things. The adipate, the suberate, the ethyl malonate need carnitine and B2 to be broken down. So if they're high, that's telling us there's not enough of these two nutrients that are going to allow them to be broken down. And so the fact that suberate is normal, although it's pretty elevated, it's high normal, and same with adipate, it's high normal. But the fact that those are normal basically means that, oh, they are maybe receiving more of carnitine and B2 than ethyl malonate, but it doesn't mean that there's a difference in interpreting results. So I hope that's making sense. So under the fatty acid metabolism, we can say, okay, this person needs carnitine and B2. Under carbohydrate metabolism here, that pyruvate's high. So they need any one of these can be involved in this, B1, B3, chromium, lipoic acid, CoQ10. So we want to consider putting somebody on a B vitamin, B complex, with some chromium, with some alpha lipoic or R-lipoic, with some CoQ10. And we see these things show up again here under the energy production with the citric acid cycle. So we see citrate, alpha-ketoglutarate, fumarate, malate, all of these are high. So we are getting more information that B complexes are needed, that CoQ10 is needed, that amino acids and magnesium are needed. So any of those can play a big role, and we definitely want to get somebody on those nutrients. Now, what's more pertinent or more difficult to interpret is as we get a little bit lower. Here in this section, B vitamins here under the B complex vitamin markers, one thing to point out here too is when we're saying below detectable limit, that means these are really low. So with a lot of these markers on this test, anything that is low is not a problem. We're really just concerned about the highs. Now, as we get to things like the neurotransmitters and especially the detox indicators, some of those low or high could be a problem. So here the methylmalonate being high, number 20, that's telling us more specifically about B12 versus the 4-aminoglutamate is more about folate. So that is one, even though this particular section, this methylation cofactor section, even though it lists B12 and folate, this is an area where methylmalonate is more B12, and then 4-aminoglutamate is more folate. So that is one area that is not, say, congruent with these other areas up here where it's like, oh, B1, B2, B3, B5, biotin could really be involved in any of these processes. And then neurotransmitter-wise, so we do have a little bit here. I'd say this is definitely starting to creep up, the 5-hydroxy and acetate, and that can be a sign of serotonin deficiency. So we might consider some of the serotonin cofactors here, such as tryptophan and B6 and SAMe, 5-HTP. Remember, if we're doing things like, especially like 5-HTP and tryptophan, sometimes even SAMe as well, we want to make sure that somebody's not on an SSRI. Okay, so detox indicators. So this is where some of the some things can be problems if they're high or if they're low. And pretty much this is an area where I definitely go in, make sure you watch that bonus video on organics that I created, because it's very important to understand that this is an area where when I researched this and researched these individual metabolites, that even though you will get only flags, if most of them are high, I think alpha hydroxybutyric, there's one of these that will get flagged if they're low. Even though generally it's flagged if they're high, when I've actually looked and researched, I've seen that all of these under detoxification can also be problems if they're low. So make sure you really get that information, that we want to make sure that high and low are actually positives on the organics, despite what the lab results say. And so the pyroglutamate and the hydroxybutyrate are both indicators of low glutathione status if either one of them are high or low. So here, when we're seeing that, oh, the hydroxybutyrate is below detectable limits and the pyroglutamate is high, those are actually telling us the same thing. Those are both telling us that glutathione status is poor. The other thing we see here with the detox one, it says 2-methylhippurate, is starting to sneak up, which is usually an issue with problems with things like xylene. So xylene exposure, xylenes are common in paints. So glycine is a nutrient that helps to break this down. So for this detox portion here, I would say definitely do glutathione, and then also make sure you do the some glycine as well. Glutathione is an interesting topic. Miles found some research that kind of debunked the idea that we need S-acetyl or liposomal glutathione in order for absorption, that glutathione was actually quite absorbable. I have seen, so we've been using more oral glutathione, and I've seen it give people, a few people, diarrhea now. So I still have a little bit of a question, despite that research study looking that glutathione was so positive. I just have a question about how well it's getting into the body. If people are actually getting diarrhea, I'm concerned that they're, it's still, you know, too much of it's flushing out. Okay, so let's look at the compounds of bacterial or yeast origin. And I'm definitely glad this particular patient ran this test, because certainly chronic UTIs, we are thinking bacteria. Now, E. coli is the most common infection with UTIs. So I'd be curious if a culture insensitivity was ever run on the urinalysis to actually identify what organism and what would kill it. I would just be curious about that as far as targeting treatment. And mainly if somebody is, if it is E. coli, the E. coli is going to respond to D. mannose. Other microorganisms that could be causing recurrent UTIs will not respond to D. mannose. So D. mannose works by basically causing the microorganism to lose attachment to the bacterial wall, so it just flushes out. So sometimes with chronic UTIs, if it is E. coli, I've had success simply by putting somebody on a long dose of D. mannose. So using something like D. mannose for 6 months to a year and just allowing the body to continue to get that signal to flush can be really helpful, but it's not going to work if it's not E. coli. So it's certainly something you could try just and see if it does work. Then you probably know it's E. coli if you're not able to get a specimen. So other things we see here on this test, this hippurate starting to sneak up here with this indican is really, really high here at a 97. So this is basically letting us know that we have a hidden bacterial infection. And so that's something then that certainly SIBO is another test to consider. With this, we do see SIBO and UTIs often go together. It's not uncommon that people will have both. So that's something to consider. Clostridia is good to see negative. Yeast is not coming up too high. I feel pretty good about the organics yeast test. It's not perfect, as we've talked to you guys about before. There really is no perfect yeast test on the market. But certainly if we see negative yeast here and negative yeast in a stool culture, we can feel pretty good about not having to treat yeast. So in response to some of your questions, in addition to other tests to do besides the organics and besides stool culture, I would absolutely do SIBO. Even if this person does not have bloating, I would definitely do that. And I would see if it's possible to get it cultured, and then, you know, maybe starting on some D-mannose. Okay, and then this is also interesting. It sounds like from a, say, mindfulness perspective, this person is really, really positive. Severe motorcycle accident, 24, was told she never walk or have children, and she walks and has 3 kids. And, you know, it sounds like it really shows, in part, the power of the body to heal when the mind is really, really powerful. So it sounds like she's had a very, you know, positive attitude on her symptoms. This other thing about passing gas in public or a loose stool not making it to the bathroom not fast enough, certainly that could be neurological, absolutely, with this history. But again, another time to consider SIBO just because it can cause that, and just to rule that out. If it is neurological, it might be interesting to try something like neurofeedback. So neurofeedback, we are changing how the brain is wired, and it's possible that something like that could help. Another thing that I would even consider would be doing something like electroacupuncture, and I would definitely make sure this person isn't seeing a chiropractor, that we want to make sure that the spine and the structure is really good, because we want to, you know, give this person, especially with this accident history, the best neurological chance possible. And it certainly could be a neurological, say, situation that's really affecting her here. All right, and then other questions. So appropriate dosage for iodine to supplement. So subclinical Hashimoto's. So this is, you know, starting at 150 micrograms for sure. You might even start at 100 micrograms. And if it's Hashi's, you know, where I said earlier where we might push somebody up to 2 to 3 milligrams, we probably do not want to push a Hashi's patient much past 1 milligram. We want to be very careful and make sure, no matter what, especially with a Hashi's patient, when we are supplementing iodine, that we are making sure to test at that 4 to 6 week mark and no longer. So preferentially even testing at 4. We just want to take extra caution with Hashi's and iodine, and definitely supplementing with selenium as well. And then the IgE test, having eaten a lot of foods before that test, it should not be affected by that in the same way an IgG testing can be affected by that. So with IgE, we're a lot safer to eat the foods. I still won't go crazy on anyone's food, but we're not going to get, say, a false negative the way that we will with an IgG. Or because an IgG, remember with an IgG, there's a couple different places that we're getting the IgG. So some of it with the IgGs can occur because of intestinal permeability, right? So with intestinal permeability, remember we have the IgGs that are making their way into the blood to react to that protein antigen that has gotten into the blood that is not supposed to be there. So that's a sign of leaky gut. And that's what we think of, remember, when we have a lot of different IgGs. Now, what's also interesting is that we can also have a situation where we can have IgGs and we cannot have intestinal permeability. And in this situation, usually it's just a few IgGs. And in this situation, when it's just a few, it often is what you're talking about, Nicola, here, about the consumption of food that is really high. So when the consumption of one particular food is really high, then what happens is it's actually, we get an IgG release from the Peyer's patches. So that high consumption will trigger a IgG response even within the intestinal lumen that can happen without leaky gut. So we want to basically be careful about the overconsumption of food, because we can trigger that Peyer's patch, say, release of some of the leaky or some of the IgGs. Okay, so this one was from Jen. And I think this one was one of the, oh no, this one we answered already. So I think that's it for these. And then I'm just gonna share with you guys too, just to go over some Lyme stuff again for you all. So some of the stuff we talked about was when to test for. So certainly if there's that bullseye rash, but remember it's only in about 25% of people. If there's a history of tick bites anytime in their life, other insects that's especially if they've reacted really strongly to other insect bites like mosquitoes, chronic fatigue, pain, you can differentiate it from arthritis by running anti-rheumatoid factors or by running anti-CCP3. Will differentiate from rheumatoid. And then headaches that don't have another origin, neurological dysfunction, brain fog, fibro, emotional dysregulation, sleep disturbances, night sweats. And if other treatments are not working, if somebody has all these things and you're starting with some of the basics, you know, you're looking at the adrenals, you're looking at hormones, you're working on the diet, you're working with mindfulness, they are doing their sleep hygiene, you've cleaned up the gut, the liver, you've worked on detox, you've done all these basic things, all the things that we mainly talk about in MMCP, and somebody is not getting better, this is a great time, especially if they have these symptoms, to think about Lyme. So one thing to know is that waking at 3:30 and being unable, that should be, to fall asleep is classic sign of Borrelia in the brain. So if somebody like wakes up at 3:30 every night and they're not falling back asleep, and they have these other symptoms, we want to think that they might have Lyme in their brain. Sudden onsets of rage. Now, sudden onsets of rage can sometimes also be like PTSD to trauma. So there's other reasons for sudden rage onset. But certainly, we want to definitely consider sudden rage onset as a Lyme thing. There's something known as Lyme rage. And so if somebody does something minor, you know, a partner doesn't take out the trash when you've asked them to, or a kid doesn't pick the socks off the floor that you told them to, whatever it is that's like really minor that should be handled in a logically a calm way. If it turns into like acute rage, that's definitely a Lyme thing. EMF, so electromagnetic frequency sensitivity, that can be linked to Lyme disease. And this can be, you know, the sensitivity can be variety of symptoms that can be caused by it. Sometimes people might notice their headache or their fatigue worsens if they're around EMFs, or they don't sleep as well. Sometimes when I was going through Lyme, I was finding that I wasn't hugely EMF sensitive. It wasn't one of my main symptoms. But if I was around a lot of EMFs, I would start to feel this like almost this like trembling, this like shaking internally. So it can be all sorts of things. If people are sensitive to EMFs, they generally know it. Burning or a sense of vibration or inward trembling is often how this is described. So it can feel kind of like this like shaking type of sensation where the body doesn't ever feel like it's still inside and it feels like this kind of internal movement. Bell's palsy, very common with Lyme. TMJ pain. So it's also important to know that the vagal nerve is basically that Borrelia, Bartonella, and herpes can all affect the vagal nerve. So infections of these type of microorganisms can really affect things like GERD, can cause chronic constipation. So if we have GERD or chronic constipation, it's just not responding to normal treatment, and you've tried a ton of different things. You know, Borrelia, Bartonella, herpes, not going to be probably the first things we think about with GERD and chronic constipation, but they should be on our differentials. So testing. So DNA connections is a test that is using PCR technology. And PCR technology has come a long way with Lyme disease. So it was once there was once concern with PCR that the DNA fragments that were looking for with this type of testing, that they would be there when somebody had Lyme and they wouldn't always be there. And in listening to some, to a podcast actually from one of the creators of the DNA Connections company, she was talking about how they really, there's no guarantee. They say that this is an acute versus a past infection, but what they are finding is that it's looking like when people are no longer infected, the fragment numbers are so low that the likelihood of it showing up on the test is very rare. So definitely feeling more and better and better about using a PCR test like DNA Connections. We are using this test in our clinic. And it also is really important with Lyme testing, in particular PCR testing, that the person get some vigorous exercise prior to doing this lab. So basically something that's going to get their heart rate up. So going for a quick jog or even doing some like whole body vibration, which is not exercise, but it gets their lymph moving really well. Deep tissue massage is another option. So we do all of these types of things, deep tissue massage, whole body vibration, a jog, any of these things are going to mobilize the microorganisms and mobilize the lymph. And basically, if the person has the disease, they are more likely going to be positive. So with a Western blot, we went over this before, but just to review a little bit, IgM. So an IgM reaction, normally we think of immunoglobulin M as being acute. And IgM does not necessarily mean acute. Okay, so that's something that I really want to make sure you remember. A negative Lyme test can turn positive after a few months of treatment. So this is another thing to consider. So if you do a Lyme test and you really think somebody might have Lyme and they come back negative, sometimes it can turn positive after a few months of treatment because in a chronic state, those microorganisms are buried so deep in the tissues, they're not going to show up in the standard urine or blood tests. So another option, if you really are concerned about a test showing positive, would be to treat for Lyme for a couple months, 2-3 months, and then do a Lyme test. So co-infections and testing, the thing I wanted to mention here is that there are co-infections. Co-infections basically mean they're microorganisms that are transmitted at the same time of that bite. So when a tick or a mosquito or a flea, something that is carrying the microorganisms, carrying the Borrelia, the Lyme, when they bite somebody, they will deliver everything in their bloodstream. So they don't just choose, oh, this person's getting Borrelia, but not something else. Basically, if they contain a cocktail of microorganisms, they are going to bite and deliver that cocktail to the person that has been bitten. So with that, we call those co-infections. So common co-infections are Bartonella, Babesia. Babesia is a parasite. Bartonella is a bacteria. Bartonella is also known as cat scratch fever. Rocky Mountain spotted fever can sometimes be a co-infection. Mycoplasma can sometimes be a co-infection. Chlamydia, not chlamydia that we think of as STD, but more chlamydia pneumoniae can be a co-infection. So there are several different things and even a few microorganisms beyond this that we need to consider. So the two most classic ones are Bartonella and Babesia. Now, there are dozens of different species of Bartonella and Babesia, and there's only tests that have been developed for these two microorganisms that are really looking at three of these different species. So we frequently do not test for the co-infections. Because of this, we kind of have a conversation with people when we're talking about co-infections, and we share this with them and say, hey, if these tests come up negative, I'm probably going to want to treat you anyways to see how you respond because the chances of false negatives are so high, not because the tests are bad, but because the tests are only looking for a few of the species. So it doesn't mean that there's a problem with the test. It just means that the test has not been developed, say, broadly enough to include all the species that could be a problem. So symptoms to consider. So Babesia, one of the common symptoms is also night sweat. So we said waking up at 3:30 a.m. is a classic Borrelia in the brain. But waking up and having night sweats all throughout the night, That is Babesia, very commonly. Mold toxins can also do that. So those are kind of the two things that we should be thinking beyond something like menopause. Babesia hijacks the red blood cells. So because it hijacks the red blood cells are not going to function. The red blood cells obviously deliver oxygen for us. So when the red blood cells get hijacked, guess what? But somebody winds up being short of breath very easily. They may express that they can't exercise like they used to. Another thing with babesia is redness. So petechiae, those little red dots that can show up on the skin and nobody, it's hard to figure out what those are. That can be a big babesia sign. So those are kind of some of the top babesia things. Oh, and irritability. Irritability is hard because of the Lyme rage thing. But if somebody has babesia and Lyme, that rage can generally be much, stronger, more intense. Bartonella. So Bartonella, cat scratch fever. So obviously this can occur from a cat scratch and could have nothing to do with Lyme disease. Common symptoms with Bartonella, one are lipomas. So lipomas, remember those fatty deposits often found in the back and the thighs, totally benign, can feel like a cyst, don't really cause any problems unless they press against the nerve. And those can be triggered by Bartonella. Bartonella lives in the lymphatic system. So lymph problems can be a sign of Bartonella. Another thing that Bartonella will do is it will can cause stretch marks. So I always ask people, do you have any stretch marks that cannot be explained by pregnancy or times in life of weight fluctuations that have been major? And if they do, that can be a Bartonella sign. I actually have some of these behind my knee, which is really, really interesting. So I actually show people and say, do you have anything that looks like this on your body? And so pain in the calves and in the bottom of the soles of the feet. So there's pain in the soles of the feet. And sometimes people describe this as like, well, I changed my shoes and that helps a little bit, but like my feet just like ache and the calves just ache, or calf cramping that's not responding to basic things like electrolytes. These can all be Bartonella things. And if somebody has one of these symptoms that I'm mentioning, I'm not generally running down the co-infection pathway super strongly. I'm considering it. But if somebody has two or three of these and they have Lyme disease, so if somebody has stretch marks and lipomas and pain in their feet, you better believe we're going to be treating them for Bartonella. And then basically what is really important, because the tests aren't very good with the co-infections, is just like anytime we're doing a supplemental trial, we want to make sure we're not changing too many things at one time. So if we're going to treat and we're going to treat presumptively for something like Bartonella, then we don't want to add anything into the mix for 2 months or so that we can actually see what it's doing. And basically anytime we're testing supplement protocols like this, really a positive, we consider a positive for like, oh, we should treat this thing, is if they feel better or if they feel worse. If they feel worse, it's likely a hoax. Remember, they are killing too fast, the toxic byproducts from killing something is building up in their blood, they're not able to get these byproducts out, so they're circulating and they're making somebody feel toxic, in which case we want to slow down the treatment because we don't want them to feel bad, but it's a sign that we need to continue. Or sometimes people start this stuff and they just feel tons better very quickly, and then we also know that we're onto something. So as far as transmission of Lyme, it's estimated that there's a 50% transmission with pregnancy. During pregnancy, it's tricky because Lyme herbs, most Lyme herbs are contraindicated with pregnancy. So pregnancy, we don't really have a lot of options. So the best thing to do is to do something like 250 milligrams twice a day of azithromycin. And because we can't use a lot of the Lyme drugs with pregnancy either. So that's really the best we can do. We definitely want to try to treat. I would recommend treating when somebody is pregnant, if it's known with the azithromycin, because it can be transmitted across the placenta. So because of that, we do want to say help the growing baby as much as possible, and also help mama too. So likely it's not transmitted with intercourse. The thought around intercourse is that there have been some microorganisms, some Borrelia microorganisms found in sexual secretions. But there has to be a certain threshold of microorganisms present for Lyme to actually, say, take hold and actually infiltrate our body. And the threshold in sexual secretions is low enough that it's thought right now in the current research and what the knowledge we have that intercourse is not likely to transmit it. It can be transmitted through breast milk. So we also do have to be careful about some of those Lyme herbs with breast milk. So generally, if people are thinking about having a kid when they're going through Lyme treatment, my recommendation to them is if they're, you know, if they're able to hold off for 6 months to a year so that we can get the Lyme more at a level where we're not really worried about the level of transmission being at a level where it's going to infect the newborn, then we want to do that. Another thing is that it hides in teeth. So it's thought to be a reason for periodontal disease, as well as like tooth pain that's not from a cavity, that's just pain of unknown origin. So it can be found in dentists that look at saliva, look at cultures under a microscope, it can actually be seen. So that's another thing to consider is, and we, you know, using microorganisms in the mouth, using probiotics in the mouth, swishing around with tea tree, doing oil pulling, certainly not going to be enough really to take care of the Lyme, but definitely are good adjunct therapies. The number one thing to remember with treatment is do not just focus on killing the microorganisms. This is where I see people get into so much trouble with Lyme, because a lot of these killing protocols, whether it's pharmaceutical or herbs, are very, very depleting to the system. They're very draining to the system. And we don't want to do too much depleting stuff. We want to also build up the body. And we oftentimes do so much killing that by the time people make it into our office frequently that have done other Lyme treatments that haven't been, say, as looking at the whole body in the same way we do, that are just really focused on the killing component, people do not feel good. Many, many times it's estimated that from a pharmaceutical perspective, that 1/3 of people get better from pharmaceuticals and 2/3 of people get worse, which obviously are really crappy statistics. And some of that, I believe, is because, as I think I've mentioned before, Lyme, the classic Lyme treatments for, from a pharmaceutical perspective, is triple antibiotic therapy for oftentimes an entire year, sometimes less, sometimes more. So you can imagine how draining that is to the micro or to the body. So order is important, but not textbook. Okay. So when we're talking about treatment of Lyme, mycotoxins, order does matter, but we do find that everybody is unique, like always. So these are general guidelines. So if somebody is in a moldy environment and is mold sensitive, getting out of that environment is number one. Then we want to start binding. So we want to start binding the mold toxins. So we start binding the mold toxins with things like chitosan, glucomannans, charcoal, bentonite. We open up the NRF2 by using things like sulforaphane and DIM or curcumin. MRP2, remember, is that liver protein that's going to help the gallbladder to flush, and we can use choline for that. And then if somebody is expressing that, if they're feeling really weak, they're feeling really bad, we often will put them on tonifying things. So we might work on their adrenals and give them a little ginseng or licorice or rhodiola, or look at B vitamins, build their system up before we start killing. And then we'll move on to killing. Now, if somebody's feeling like fairly good, and despite having mold or Lyme, they're making it through, and they're actually not reporting to say it greatly affecting their life, you might not need to do this tonifying thing first. You might be able to just move into this killing and tonifying. And by alternating killing and tonifying, what I mean is we want to do, say, things that are going to kill the microorganism for a couple weeks, and then do a week of things that are going to build the body back up. And then we want to kill again for a couple weeks and then build the body up. So we're always strengthening the body. So pros and cons of herbs versus antibiotics. So herbs can treat multiple infections at one time. antibiotics, it's not a very good idea to do this. They're too strong and we need too many at one time, even for one microorganism to work very well. So it's just too much for the body to handle. So antibiotics, we do not treat one thing. So if we're suspecting somebody has Borrelia, Babesia, Bartonella, these other co-infections, and we're using antibiotics, we would only say, oh, we're just going to treat Borrelia until we're done with it. And then we're just going to treat Bartonella. And then we're just going to treat Babesia. Herbs, we can actually do multiple at one time. Antibiotics only kill them when they're replicating. So that's part of why somebody has to be on antibiotics oftentimes for so long, because these microorganisms go through life cycles, and if they're not replicating, the antibiotics don't work very well. Versus the herbs work much better. And we always, whether it's herbs or antibiotics, we recommend alternating killing and tonifying. So Lyme does have biofilms. So that's important to remember. So we definitely want to do something like a biofilm disruptor no matter what course of treatment. A great biofilm disruptor for Lyme is stevia. So just having somebody use stevia in their diet every day can be a great treatment for Lyme and for the biofilms. So Herxheimer reactions. So Herxheimer reactions basically are due to what I've mentioned, when there's a change or when we are killing so many things at one time, and perhaps there's already a backup in the liver, and we are killing and we're having a buildup of the toxins at a rate that's faster than we can eliminate them. Now, when this happens, obviously, that is going to cause a problem. And so that as these toxins build up, they can cause a lot of symptoms, and the person can feel worse before they feel better. We don't want to do that. Sometimes it's unavoidable while we're getting people through treatment, or unavoidable while we're finding doses, but that's an inflammatory reaction. We are inflaming somebody. We are making them more inflamed. We're causing more oxidative stress to somebody that already has oxidative stress. Sensitization occurs in very commonly in Lyme, where product that is normally working no longer works anymore. And we see this with pharmaceuticals and with herbs. So it's really important to rotate treatment. Gut inflammation equals a higher sensitization. So if somebody has infections or intestinal permeability, we're going to have to rotate products more frequently. If a product is no longer working, if a product seemed like it was working a lot and then it's not, that's a sign of sensitization. So Lyme has a few different forms. So we often rotate products to kind of affect the different forms. So grapefruit seed will attack what's called the cyst form of Lyme. Sublingual beta-glucuronidase, so the enzyme beta-glucuronidase sublingually, can inhibit T cells. Cemento and Banderol are basically going to be anti-Lyme treatments. That's from a company called Nutramedics, and it's from a protocol called the Cowden Protocol. Niacin is a really important supplement for our Lyme because it gets into the brain. Obviously, 1 gram 3 times a day is really high. We need the flushing type works a lot better, probably because of the vasodilation is helping it get into the brain. But it's important when we're treating somebody for Lyme to use niacin. Cistus T is a great anti-Lyme protocol. You need a lot of it, 8 cups per day. So stevia, I mentioned. Artemisia is another option with Lyme. And you can get a colloidal silver spray. Lyme gets in the eyes too. So Lyme lives, you know, all in the head. So it's in the brain, it's in the teeth, it's in the eyes. And so if somebody's having eye problems, I actually had a patient this week with Lyme who was noticing as we started Lyme treatment, one of her pupils would not dilate. And so we backed things off and things went back to normal. But that's a sign to us that, oh, there's probably Lyme here. So you can actually get a colloidal silver spray and to get Lyme out of the eye. And you just do one puff into the eyes every day. And then you want to use chlorella and other binders. So other Lyme treatments, Beyond Balance is another Lyme company. So you can do one drop of their number one product and increase one drop twice a day, increase by one drop every 10 days. They have a BB2 product that's more generally on Lyme and co-infection. So BB1, that product focuses just on Lyme. BB2 is kind of Lyme and co-infections. And basically, after 2 to 3 months of being treated with Lyme, the cyst form, if there's a cyst form is kind of like its dormancy form. That cyst form can come out again if it's still living there. So sometimes we want to consider after 2 to 3 months of doing Lyme treatment of basically having, you know, take a 2 to 3 month break and then do another round. Melatonin is anti-Lyme. Byron White is another Lyme company, another chronic infection company, product line. Byron White is their name. Their formula, they don't talk about their stuff, their products online at all. So they list them, but they don't really tell you what it's for. So the AL one is the one for Lyme. Low-dose immunoglobulin therapy is something that we generally have to be working with the prescribing doctors to do, but that's another thing that's being used in the industry for Lyme right now. Cemento and Banderol, I already mentioned from Nutramedics, they can help with the biofilm. And then acute Lyme without co-infections, treatment's really short, oftentimes 6 weeks. Acute Lyme with co-infections, still pretty short, 3 months. But when we're talking about chronic Lyme and co-infections, we're talking 6 months minimum and oftentimes a year or more. So we also want to make sure that we take care of of Candida and SIBO. And there is a relationship with how long somebody has Lyme and how long before they are better. So if somebody's had Lyme for 30 years, it's probably going to take longer, maybe even a couple years for them to be better. So treatment, Lyme treatment is definitely not clear. Some people say that doxy is all that is needed. Some say acutely IV doxy at 400 milligrams per day is all that is needed. But I definitely don't see very good long-term results with that. So acute, another option is we can do doxy for 3 weeks plus a cell wall drug and a cystic drug. That will basically take care of all of the other forms of Lyme. Now, what's interesting is this concept of persister cells, and we know that doxy does not touch persister cells. So persister cells are seen with Lyme and only a couple other microorganisms out there. And basically when bacteria have their DNA structure, that plasmid, if you guys remember back to biology, they have that plasmid. And when bacteria, say, change, when they morph, when they share their plasmids, they share their genetic material, they learn from each other, the original copy, that DNA copy, is no longer found by most microorganisms. So it's almost like microorganisms evolve, and as they evolve, there's not remnants of the original self. But Lyme's interesting because Lyme has these things called persister cells, which is no matter how much the organism evolves, there are still cells that remain within its structure that are the original cells that never actually change. So that makes it respond differently than other cells. And it also means that drugs like doxy that don't touch the persisters probably are not totally getting to the root cause of the issue. So what we do, we use a combination of 3 different Chinese herbal formulas. These formulas have different herbs in them. And these herbs that we named them Defeat the Spirochete 1, 2, and 3, these herbs are from research around leptospirosis, around syphilis, some of these other spirochete-like microorganisms, because there's just not a lot of research on Borrelia itself. They're also based upon some of Buhner's protocol. So Buhner is a herbalist that has spent many years working and studying Lyme from an herbal perspective. So number 1 and number 2 are basically kind of the killer formulas. We rotate through them. And then number 3 is tonifying. So, and then this is only part of what we do. We also mix these protocols with some of the other things that I've talked about in here, grapefruit seed, niacin, the Byron White formulas. But what we'll do with the Defeat the Spirochete 1, 2, and 3 is we'll have somebody on number 1 for 1 week, then number 2 for 1 week, then number 3 for 1 week, and then we'll rotate. And we'll do this protocol several times, so for a few months, and then we'll say, okay, put the Defeat the Spirochete on the side, switch to a different protocol because we don't want sensitization to happen. The other thing that we'll use is hyaluronic acid. So hyaluronic acid, we'll use it sometimes with just number three, but usually for all three, number one, two, and three. And we do that because hyaluronic acid is one of the things that feeds Lyme. So one of the reasons Lyme causes a lot of pain is because it loves to live in the joints, because it will feed on hyaluronic acid, which is in higher amounts in our joints. So by giving hyaluronic acid, what we're doing is we're essentially drawing the Lyme out of the joints into the bloodstream where the antimicrobials are. Molybdenum also works for this as well. So some of these Chinese herbs, so number one, the purpose is basically on delivering the herbs to the joint tissue, versus number two, delivers the herbs to the brain and to the neural tissue. So we're kind of rotating the target between the joints and the brain, which are two areas where spirochetes really congregate. And then we're, the number three is really just to tonify and build up the immune system. And also number one and two, one of the problems with so many killing herbs is that they're really hard. When I say they're draining, they're really hard on the digestive system. So the number three is designed to kind of build that digestive system back up so that if we've, say caused a weaker digestion somewhat because of those other harsher formulas, that we are building the person back up and we're not causing any long-term harm by trying to get the microorganism out. So how much to dose with anything with Lyme? Go slow. And this is an area where we find treatment is so different from person to person. So, niacin, yes, 1 gram 3 times a day, for example, is where we want people to be if we can. But we'll start at 500 milligrams per day. And so with anything, you'll see like the Byron White formulas and the Beyond Balance, we're looking at just a drop or two that we're starting with and working up from there. So with any Lyme treatment, you always want to start low because people will herx, and sometimes people will herx really, really bad, even from the smallest amount. So go extremely slow. And then we're always going to consider co-infections, molds, metals, Marcons. And so next time we meet, if we have time, we will go over some co-infection treatment. I wasn't don't have any of that ready for you guys yet, as usually we have more submissions to go through, but we got through everything quickly tonight. So that's pretty much what I have for you guys tonight. I know Sherry, you're only the only person actively on this call. Do you have any questions for me? Anything you need help with, anything I can help you answer? Okay, we'll keep the submissions coming and, it looks like, okay, you said you're good. Okay, great. Keep the submissions coming so we can definitely continue on with making sure that you guys are clear on things. And have a great evening, and I look forward to seeing you all next time. Take good care.